On this episode of the ASC Podcast with John Gailey, we debrief our visit to the Ohio State Association meeting, discuss the latest news in the ASC industry, including the major announcement from CMS regarding potential changes to the conditions for coverage. And in our focus segment, we talk about dealing with and avoiding adverse events, and we interview Ridley Barron, author of Twist of Faith, the story of how he dealt with a medical error that shattered his life.
Welcome to the ASC Podcast with John Gailey, a bi-weekly podcast for anyone interested in the freestanding ambulatory surgery industry. This episode is sponsored by Ambulatory Healthcare Strategies. The ASC regulatory environment is increasingly challenging, but organizations that outsource the regulatory oversight to Ambulatory Healthcare Strategies have an edge. AHS works with ASCs to oversee their quality improvement, risk management, emergency and infection control programs, run their meetings, develop education programs, and always be prepared for surveys. Welcome to episode 38 of the ASC Podcast with John Gailey for Monday, October 1st, 2018. We're recording from our studio in Rochester, New York. This is Sue Cronkite, Senior Nurse Consultant with AHS. I'm here with John Gailey. John is one of the leading experts in all aspects of the freestanding ambulatory surgery industry, and he's the author of over 10 books about the ASC industry. John is a nationally known speaker and the owner of Ambulatory Healthcare Strategy. So, John, another busy weekend, your 40th high school reunion. You hate to admit it.
I hate to admit it. Doesn't seem that way, but yeah, it's been kind of an interesting week. One of my best friends from high school stayed with me, and we visited for a few days, and we all commiserated on getting older and trying to remember what it was like, and what I think we all agree it was a much simpler time. We look at everything going on in the world right now. 1978 was far simpler than it is today.
Well, thank God I don't age at all. I have no idea.
So you're still 20. Your fifth is coming up, right?
Sure.
I think what was interesting to me is how we're reminded during this reunion of how those things that we assumed we were going to do when we grew up rarely pan out to be what we actually do. You know, for example, I wanted to be a famous science fiction writer. So, first of all, I'm not a fiction writer. I am a writer, but certainly not science fiction. And look where I am today. And I think all of us out there, probably in our audience too, probably has some interesting stories about how they ended up in a different career than they thought they would.
So. I know, and it can seem kind of melancholy, sort of. But then it can also be such an adventure that things have turned out so differently than you ever thought they would. Life goes in different directions.
So we're back from the Ohio State Association. We just finished putting the episode up for the Ohio State Association. So if you are in the state of Ohio or are interested in what's going on in the state of Ohio, there is a special episode dated last week, which is September 24th, and where we had an opportunity to interview members of the board of directors and the executive director to kind of update everybody on what's going on in Ohio and what a great organization they have out there. So I want to thank everybody from the Ohio State Association for a wonderful conference and for the opportunity to speak from their conference. We had a lot of great sessions, you know, and it was there, Sue, that we learned that CMS proposed a rule in the regulatory simplification. We were a little bit behind in the news, about 2 days behind there because we were on the road so much. And luckily, we found out about it. So we're going to do a little section in a few minutes on what happened there. And again, always, it's a great opportunity to see all of our friends and our loyal podcast listeners. So thank you for coming up to us while we were there and talking about how they like our podcast. So I guess we'll keep doing it. What do you say?
So we're back to the real world this week. We'll be heading down to Pennsylvania for the association meeting on Monday. So we're leaving in a couple hours.
Yep. And I'm not sure if we're doing a special episode from there. I know there's been some confusion as to whether we have some time. It's a very busy association meeting. So I don't know if we can fit in the recording there. And one of the problems is I have to head out to Kansas City. I'm going to be at the 2018 New Health Nursing and Quality Leader Conference doing a speech out there. So, and then back to Rochester to try to spend some time with my Western New York clients, who I haven't seen in a while since I spent so much time in the city. So, Sue, why don't you kind of give us a little update on what's going on in the news?
Okay, just a couple little things. I just wanted to mention the flu season because that is starting. Ours kind of runs from October to March. They're saying that hopefully it's going to be a little milder this year. That would be nice. I know it was a bad one last year. Yeah. They were watching in Australia. Their flu season runs from May to October. And it had been a mild season so far. So, you know, obviously we know it can all mutate. So no promises, but we're hoping. I know last year, 80,000 people died in the U.S. And globally, over 500,000 people die each year from the flu. So it really can be serious. And I know everybody in healthcare, we're pretty good about getting our shots, but just a reminder. And then
the big news
is the CMS publishing the new proposed rules. There's three big parts to that.
Right. And first of all, a little bit of background on it. So the rule was published on September 20th by CMS, and it's entitled Regulatory Provisions to Promote Program Efficiency, Transparency, and Burden Reduction. This proposed rule is in response to President Trump's Executive Order 13771, which ordered federal agencies to find ways to reduce the regulatory burden on organizations such as healthcare facilities. And the summary of this proposed rule is this proposed rule would reform Medicare regulations that are identified as unnecessary, obsolete, or excessively burdensome on healthcare providers and suppliers. This proposed rule would increase the ability of healthcare professionals to devote resources to improving patient care by eliminating or reducing requirements that impede quality patient care or that divert resources away from furnishing high-quality patient care.
So I guess kind of focusing your resources on what you need to do, but we're a little unsure about some of these
changes. Yeah, there's three main provisions to it. The first one was the transfer agreements for hospitals, which I think in general is probably a good provision here. CMS is proposing to remove the requirements that ASCs have a transfer agreement, which on a face doesn't sound good, but we all know that most of our surgery centers have, you know, physicians that are affiliated with the hospital. And we also know that EMTALA, which is the Emergency Medical Treatment and Labor Act, forces hospitals to accept patients in an emergency situation.
So CMS states this would address the competition barriers that currently exist in some situations where hospitals providing outpatient surgical services refuse to sign written transfer agreements or grant admitting privileges to physicians performing surgery in an ASC. The Emergency Medical Treatment and Labor Act, as you mentioned, EMTALA, emergency response regulations would continue to address emergency transfer of a patient from an ASC to a nearby hospital, but the problem comes with non-emergency cases.
Right. We know that very few of our cases that are going to the hospital are actually emergencies because we respond immediately. We have to respond immediately to anything that's life-threatening. And hopefully by the time the patient is stabilized, they go to the hospital and you're no longer in an emergency situation.
Yeah. And so as we know, sometimes it's not even, it's something we find as we're checking them in, a high blood pressure or something where we just need them to go someplace.
Right. They haven't even had the procedure yet. So I think that's my concern with removing this requirement. Yeah. On the other hand, I think the better solution would be to find a way to kind of force hospitals to have transfer agreements with the surgery center so that we don't run into this situation.
Yeah, because that seems to be the most protective areas where you have places, as they mentioned, where the hospitals are so against the ASCs and they're trying to make things difficult, so they may refuse a transfer agreement, which puts them in a tough spot. So the other requirement that they might take off, which I know we're a little leery about this, the requirements for comprehensive medical history and physical assessment. They're proposing to remove that and replace with requirements that defer to a certain extent to the ASC policy and operating physician's clinical judgment to ensure that patients receive the appropriate pre-surgical assessments tailored to the patient and the type of surgery being performed. The operating physician must still document any pre-existing medical conditions and appropriate test results in the medical record, which would have to be considered before, during, and after surgery. In addition, all pre-surgical assessments must include documentation regarding any allergies to drugs and biologicals, and that the medical history and physical examination, if completed, be placed in the patient's medical record prior to the surgical procedure. But that can be a little concerning, I think.
Well, it already is concerning me. So, so the word is out there already.
Yes.
Soon after this was announced, I got a text message from one of the owners of one of my surgery centers basically saying, so we no longer need to do H&Ps. I mean, and which is exactly what I was concerned with this when we read it, that people would assume that it means we don't do H&Ps. Mm-hmm. And of course, you know, first thing I said is, first of all, this is proposed. It's not in place. And second, it's not removing the requirement for an H&P. It's removing the requirement for a comprehensive H&P when those circumstances merit. Yeah. And I think that's where we are going to have a constant battle with physicians to make sure that we have appropriate information. Now, a couple things that we need to note. This is the federal rule. So if your state requires you to have a comprehensive history and physical, you're still going to be required to have a comprehensive history and physical.
Like New York State.
So I'd say that quite a number of those states have those rules, and it's much less likely that they're going to remove those rules. And it takes longer to remove those rules generally at the state level. And the accrediting organizations are likely to keep those rules in place for some time also. So so this isn't going to cause a huge change right away. Especially in those states that require licensure and for organizations that require accreditation. But I think we're concerned. So during the Ohio State Association conference, Karen Newberry talked about this. And then later, Bill Prentice kind of noted that with these proposed changes, we're all concerned that people are going to get the message that you don't need to do a histories and physicals anymore. So the ASC Association is looking at this deeply. They're trying to figure out how to respond to this and point out that this is one of those requirements. And I'm not sure we really want to have removed or that we want reworded such that we can really emphasize the importance of having a history and physical. When it is merited.
Yeah, we don't want that gray area where the care might not be quite what we hope. And even on top of that is how it might look to outside places, like some of these articles that we've seen come out. We don't need more fuel to the fire to you know, have people draw assumptions that are just not true.
Yeah, it's a bad time to be reducing our standards. Last section was
Emergency preparedness. So several changes were proposed regarding the emergency preparedness requirements that healthcare providers and suppliers must comply with, and the following would apply to the ASCs. The review of emergency plans can be done every 2 years instead of annually. They can eliminate the requirement that facilities document efforts to contact local, tribal, regional, state, and federal emergency preparedness officials. They still need to coordinate with them, but the facilities wouldn't have to document that anymore. So it's kind of a bizarre.
Yeah, I don't understand one at all, really. I mean, I guess what they're saying is they're going to take our word for it, that we tried to do that. I don't know.
I don't know. I would probably document it anyways, because just in healthcare, you kind of learn, you just document it.
Right.
The training requirement changed from every year to every 2 years, or when emergency preparedness is significantly updated. They would reduce the testing exercise to one per year instead of two. The first year live or community-wide, and second can be tabletop or a workshop that includes a group discussion led by a facilitator. And that's a new thing, the workshop.
Right. I'm actually kind of excited about that. I think we don't have a lot of guidance on what they mean by that. But a workshop, in my view, could actually be much more effective than even a tabletop or a live drill. So we'll see where it comes from. But we're already working on some ideas for that. So.
And providers are exempt from the next required exercise after an event requiring activation of an emergency preparedness plan. Like if, you know, a real emergency, if you're a facility must deal with a flood,
a wildfire,
you know, whatever, that type of thing. So ASCA leadership, including the Government Affairs Committee, are in the initial stage of formulating the association's formal response.
The actual response is due November 19th, 2018. So if anybody wants to chime in also, this is open for public comment during that period. So just, you know, my observations here, the changes requiring, you know, going to biannual instead of annual, I'm not sure that's terribly useful. I think most organizations have an annual cycle for education anyway, and including the emergency preparedness, you know, since you have to do fire safety every year, you have to do disaster preparedness every year. I think changing the emergency preparedness to every 2 years just confuses the issue.
Yeah, that was kind of underwhelming. I don't know that really there's,
I don't think there's a change.
Our regulatory burden. We really recommend a lot of actual changes following this.
Right. Reducing the testing exercise frequency, though, I think is going to be very helpful because that was burdensome to have that every quarter. We have to remind people that state regulations and accreditation standards will, of course, trump anything that CMS has proposed here. So I'm very encouraged by the changes in the emergency preparedness because we do know how burdensome those have been. So those were definitely very good steps. So let's take a short break, and our focus segment is going to be on medical errors and adverse events. And we're going to have a very special interview with Ridley Barron, who lost a son as a result of a medical error.
According to a study by Johns Hopkins University in 2016, medical errors are an under-recognized cause of death. 10% of all U.S. deaths are now due to medical error, and the third highest cause of death in the U.S. is medical error. Analyzing medical death rate data over an 8-year period, Johns Hopkins patient safety experts have calculated that more than 250,000 deaths per year are due to medical error in the U.S. Their figure, published May 3rd, surpasses the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention's third leading cause of death, respiratory disease, which kills 150,000 people per year.
So for more information about the study, I provided a link on the website for this week's episode with a summary of the study. And by the way, Sue, we should point out that was May 3rd, 2016 was the date of this particular study that was done. Mm-hmm. So we know that deaths in ASCs are exceedingly rare. But even one death is one too many, and avoiding deaths and other adverse events must continue to be a primary focus of our quality improvement efforts. And, you know, one of my concerns, Sue, and I know you feel the same way as we go and visit centers and when I do surveys, is that some of the owners of surgery centers really think that quality improvement is just a paperwork thing, that, mm-hmm. you know, that all we do is document and document and document. Mm-hmm. And that, truthfully, I think sometimes people don't really respect the importance of quality improvement, don't understand mm-hmm. the importance of quality improvement.
You gather the information and the numbers, but it's what you do with them.
Right.
You know, which makes it not only more useful, but really more interesting.
Right. And what we want to do is we want to learn from our past mistakes, and we want to follow mm-hmm. the trends to try to figure out if something is getting better, you know, as a result of efforts mm-hmm. that we put into place, or if things are not going in the right direction and therefore require some type of an intervention to improve them. So I think the point that we need to make, and we certainly say this all the time because we think most of our centers are absolutely fantastic, mm-hmm. is that no matter how good you think you are, there is always room for improvement. And this is a very different world that we're living in. It's one of the things we're talking about during my reunion is that, you know, in 1978, you know, we had a different world. We were accepting things differently mm-hmm. there. I remember my parents had this car that you could only turn right mm-hmm. because if you turn left, the car would stall. Yeah. And, you know, and there's a bit of an exaggeration. But nonetheless, the point being is that we accepted that level of quality of our automobiles. Mm-hmm. We don't accept it anymore. Yeah. And the same thing happens in everything that we buy. We mm-hmm. have so many options here. We have so many options for products. We have so many options mm-hmm. for services. And thankfully, we have so many options for healthcare. Mm-hmm. And that means that we have to continue to be the best at what we do because we are yeah. constantly being evaluated by our customers, that is our patients. So we have in this world, I think we have a different, what we would call an outcome orientation in all aspects of our lives. So people are expecting quality products, quality services. And as we mentioned, you know, healthcare is a highly competitive environment. Mm-hmm. But articles such as the Kaiser Health Network and the USA Today attack pieces recently show that people are desperate for information about the quality of care that we provide. And if we don't give them that information, and I should emphasize, if we don't give them that information, yeah. misleading information like that provided in the Kaiser and the USA Today articles will be taken as facts. Mm-hmm. You know, fortunately for us, we have a lot of information that we've been able to provide. But Kaiser, of course, and USA Today didn't choose to use that information, yeah. didn't choose to follow up on that information. And when they wrote those articles, all you had was the bad side there, which was extremely misleading. So one of the reasons that we do QI is to make sure that we have the availability of that information to prove how good we are. So, you know, I think we want to do is encourage your employees out there to find ways to improve the services, to report incidents and near misses. And we need to remove those barriers to reporting mm-hmm. by assuring people that we're not looking to blame anybody, but we're only to improve.
It's a great way to get people re-engaged, I think, in their jobs right. too, because, you know, you come up with this project of how to make things better. You know, even as you said, if there's not a huge problem, but fewer cancellations, right. you know, patient satisfaction.
Right.
And, you know, you can really brainstorm and come up with some great ways.
Absolutely. And as you said, just said now, you know, the ideal world is patient walks in the door, they immediately go up to the registration desk, they get signed in right away, they turn around, they go into the pre-op area, they have the minimum amount of time in pre-op before they go into mm-hmm. surgery, then they go into post-op, and they're out within an hour. And of course, that's ideal. We're never mm-hmm. going to get to that point. But most of our organization, I would say that very few of our organizations are able to do that day in, day out. Mm-hmm. As a matter of fact, I would say none of them are able to do that day in, day out. So if that's not a good example of how we really need to continue to work on improving the quality, then I don't know what else is.
We just went out to breakfast this morning with my mom, and we waited and waited and waited for our food to come. We waited and waited for the bill. And I mean, even my mom, who, you know, no offense to her, but she doesn't have a really busy schedule. Right. She's 85. You know, she was visiting with us, but she was checking her watch. She was getting so irritated. And honestly, we left there saying, I don't know if we'll go back there again. And we love the food, but
one of our favorite restaurants.
Yeah, but it's
one incident.
Yeah. And honestly, I mean, it was the waiting was annoying, but if somebody had ever come, we never saw the waitress before we finally went up to pay and just sort of like, but if
she had come
and even said, oh my God, you know, it's so busy here today, said something. So as you're saying, if something's going on in the center, if things aren't always perfect, of course, but showing that you're aware of, geez, you know, we know there's an extra long wait. We're sorry. Can we get you some coffee? Or I don't know, you know, just not before surgery.
But, right.
You know, just some kind of way to smooth those things over, and it can make a huge difference because those things stick with you and you can lose people quickly.
And one incident is all it takes in order to ruin them for life. But we've been going to that restaurant for, you know, many, many years.
Yeah, and you just feel like, you know, do they not even care? You know, so it's it grows in your mind bigger than what the actual thing was, just because you don't feel like you were valued.
Right, absolutely. So that's segues into our interview, and we had an opportunity during the California State Association meeting about a month ago to interview Ridley. And I'm going to forewarn everybody that this is a tough interview. Mm-hmm. His is a tough message, and he wrote a book. Basically, what happened is his son died as a result of a medical error in a hospital in 2004, and Ridley wrote a book called A Twist of Faith that chronicles his story and provides advice on how healthcare organizations can avoid errors and how they occur and how to better deal with them.
Yeah, and if you ever get a chance to hear him speak, his talk, we hadn't seen it when we interviewed him. And afterwards when we did, it was just so touching. He's a wonderful person.
At the end of the interview, he notes that, you know, that he loves to ask questions. And there was not a single question, because I think we were all kind of shocked by the story. And the people did comment is that thank you so much for sharing that story.
Yeah.
So this is going to be a tough one for people to listen to, but it's important for us as healthcare providers to listen to it, not just as human beings, but also as providers to see what he suggested. So let's listen to that interview, and then we'll talk a little bit about it at the end.
We're here at the 2018 CASA Annual Conference. John and I are talking to Ridley Barron.
So Ridley, you've got an interesting message. I've heard you speak before. I'm very excited to hear your session, which is later today, I believe. And you and I share something. I'm a Presbyterian pastor, and you are a...
I am a Southern Baptist minister. You probably can tell that from the drawl.
That's right. So tell us a little bit about yourself.
I have been in the ministry all my adult life, but was thrust into a situation 14 years ago, circumstances that touched my family's life, a personal tragedy. And because of my response to that, was given an avenue by which I could go into hospitals and talk about that personal event as well as what I learned through those experiences. And so that's what I've been doing for the last 14 years, including this afternoon here at the CASA conference.
Wonderful. So your session's entitled Every Half Second Counts. Tell us how you came to that title and a little bit about your story.
Absolutely. My family was in a horrible car accident on the way home from a spring break trip in April of 2004. My wife was driving at the time, and she was killed instantly in the accident. My son was taken to a hospital in Savannah, Georgia, where he was later overdosed with five times the required medication for a child his son's size, and he died from that medication error. So as a result of that, obviously a lot of outpouring of love for my family, those kinds of things. But in a conversation about 3 weeks after the accident, a friend of mine asked a simple question. He said, how fast were the vehicles going when they made contact? And I shared with him that they had been determined to be doing 55 miles an hour when they made impact. And off the top of his head, he said, did you realize that at that speed, if your van had arrived at this intersection just a half second sooner or later, this wreck would have never happened? And that left such an impact on me as someone who had survived those circumstances, but just realizing that as human beings, we all go through half-second decisions that we have to make. You know?
So you speak about this topic quite a bit.
Right.
And give us a thrust of your session.
Well, obviously, I will share the details of this story because I come as somebody who's experienced what – a lot of people hear about in training sessions and classes and things of that nature, but here's somebody who's lived through this.
Right.
And so I share a great detail the stories of what happened, but I also share some things my family learned through those experiences that hopefully encourage the hearts of healthcare workers. I've never had a negative approach towards healthcare workers just because I understand they're human beings like I am, and none of them set out to hurt anybody or harm anybody. But what my story does serve to do is it serves to remind people how important it is that you take those half seconds to pay attention to what you're doing, that little decisions have the potential to impact people in ways you never expected. And so I'll share those things with them. And then usually there's a really good opportunity at the end for Q&A because it helps to bring my story to a personal level of where they are, where they serve, or even their own personal circumstances they're going through.
And I know when something happens like that, you try to look at every little thing that led up to it. It's not usually one major bad decision. It's all these little things. And it's just so difficult to hear, but everybody that hears it, I'm sure, really stop and think and take it so seriously.
Well, and I think what's interesting with your perspective is we're hearing it from a family member. Often we focus, if the incident happened to a patient, we talk to the patient or we talk to the other healthcare providers, but you bring a unique. So what have you learned about the healthcare system as a result of this?
Amazingly enough, one of the first things I learned is that the healthcare system our country is made up of some incredible people. You don't get to do what you do as a healthcare worker serving the community the way you do without having some kind of really big heart. You know, and so that's part of why, like I said, I want to try to encourage their hearts and hopefully help them re-engage with the call that's on their lives. Because I believe that people serve in healthcare just like you and I do because of a call on our lives in ministry, a call on their lives to do this for people. So I try to help re-engage them with that. But I guess the other thing I've learned is that there's a lot of common sense things out there that really aren't as common as we think they are. Maybe it's things that are drilled home in nursing school or in their early years as a new healthcare worker. But over time and with repetition, they begin to forget those things. And so my story serves to remind them of some very basic things. In fact, I had a doctor years ago tell me, he said, please don't take any offense to this. He said, but what you share is not rocket science, but it's extremely important.
Right.
Yeah.
So.
And it's these real life stories, of course, that help us to remember how important it is that we're dealing with lives and that we have a real story behind every incident that we have to investigate and look into.
And when I first got started, I think that was the initial appeal to this was because there are a lot of people who experience this, unfortunately, in our country. Some choose to do nothing with it. Unfortunately, way too many of them choose to be very negative about it and enter into litigation and those kinds of things. But I chose to forgive.
Right.
And because of that the vice president of risk management at the hospital where the incident occurred immediately said, look, because of your response to this, we think you could be an ally for us.
Yeah.
And I thought, man, that makes sense to me. It's a no-brainer because it's a whole lot more good can come out of this than if I turn my heart towards a negative attitude. So
that's such a good point because the thought of forgiving and not being angry, it's hard to comprehend. But then look at all the good that you've done.
Yeah.
That wouldn't have happened, or you could have sued people, but it just wouldn't have had the same effect.
Right. Well, and the truth is, and I always try to make this clear when I share with people, forgiveness for me is not, and I don't believe for anybody, is a feeling you ever feel. And it's not a once and done kind of thing. 14 years later, there's still moments where I have to intentionally choose to forgive. But it's important to me. It was important early on because I knew my two kids needed a good dad, and I couldn't be the dad they needed if I chose to be better. I now have two more kids and a new wife, and I, of course, I'm leading a church, and it's not a real good example for me to say, hey, go forgive everybody else, but I'm going to hold on to my grudges.
So how did you help the hospital after this whole event? You obviously had a good attitude. They had a good attitude toward this. What were you able to do, and what do you feel is your biggest accomplishment working with them?
Well, I don't know that I really was able to do much for them or with them. They were a teaching hospital, so they took my story immediately and began to use it in other places to teach.
Right. Mm-hmm.
But I think it spurred them in their own personal journey towards safety because they had started this progress before the incident with my son. In fact, I have been told that when they got the news about my son that day, the team that was in charge of that movement towards a more safe culture, that they all just immediately broke down in tears because of all the hard work that had been put into this. And here we are with still another death.
Right.
But I think my son's story, if you will, kind of gave fuel to the fire that was already there.
Right.
Things that kind of had been put on the back burner because maybe they couldn't find enough money to get it done, or maybe there wasn't the motivation to get it done. Suddenly, my son's name and his story kind of provided the impetus for a lot of that.
We should probably point out, I don't think you mentioned how young your son was.
He was 17 months old.
Yeah.
Yeah. In fact, like, for instance, shortly after that, every new employee at the hospital received a name badge with the initials JB on it for my son's name, just to remind them of what can happen when you don't do things with care. So
before you took on a pastoral responsibility, you were working with an organization that you created, correct?
Yes, yes.
Can you tell us a little bit about that, and is that still around?
Actually, I was still pastoring at the time. In fact, the day before the accident occurred, I had made a commitment to move back to Nashville, Tennessee, where my wife and I had lived before, to start a new church. And we decided to go ahead and do that. So I moved to Franklin with my two surviving children. We started that new church, and we served there for about 7 years. But after about 7 years, the opportunities I was given in the healthcare side of things became so abundant that I thought something's suffering on both sides, and so I need to make a decision.
Right.
So for the last 7 years, it's been full time. And so I have a ministry. It's called Ridley Barron Incorporated. Real original name there. And the idea was just that we would come along and try to help hospitals that were striving for safety, really, really try to help second victims in healthcare, because that's a real passion of ours, and just try to generate these real honest conversations about what we can do together to make healthcare better.
What's the real takeaway from your session today for our audience?
Two things. Number one, obviously, this message of take care of your half seconds, because those half second decisions in your personal and your professional life both are critical. But for me, the most important message I share for everybody is that every single day that you are given an opportunity to get up and have life, you have the opportunity to choose to respond however you want to the things that come in your life. It could be the good things that you celebrate and you get great joy out of, but tragedies like this have opportunities to learn from. And so it's all in how you approach it and how you receive it.
Now, I know you said it was a medication error.
Yes.
Did they look back and figure out what the different steps were that could have prevented it and what actually happened?
The root cause analysis after my son's event put the blame squarely on the shoulders of the pharmacist. Okay. Senior pharmacist who made a mistake, simply grabbed an adult dosage instead of a pediatric dosage. Okay. Nobody in the pharmacy to double check her medication. And so when she sent it to the floor, it appeared to be correct. Nurses did everything they did on the floor to have it verified by another nurse, those kinds of things. But it wasn't until the pharmacist who filled the prescription downstairs came back from a quick lunch break and saw her workstation, she realized she had pulled the wrong one, that they understood what had happened. And my understanding is that after the event with Josh, that the policy was changed in the pharmacy downstairs, that every medication, even if you were a senior pharmacist, required a double check before it was sent up. That was something that was not required at the time. Yeah. And they also implemented barcode scanning, which they had not done yet. So all those things would have been things that would have prevented his situation.
I'm so sorry all of that.
Thank you. Yeah, you know, an interesting thing, too, that they don't really get a chance to talk to out there because, you know, I'm given an hour to talk. But Wayne Marchant, who is the vice president of risk management at the hospital 5 years after my son's death, did a survey of people who were involved in the situation that day. He was just curious about, you know, responses and feelings and things. And even though the nurse and the doctor who ordered the medication that day had nothing to do with his death, they had done all things, they were still having nightmares about my son 5 years later.
Yeah.
Probably. And I feel like especially to be the one that attached that medication and put it in, even if just can't.
Well, in the short time between administering it to him and the pharmacist calling to let him know the mistake she had made, the nurse and the doctor apparently tried to tear apart the room, hoping it was just a bad machine or something had gone wrong there, because everything on the medication looked right, and they could not figure out what was causing the problem until the pharmacist made the phone call.
Wow. Oh, my God.
So,
well, I'm sure you've made such a huge difference.
Well, you know, and that's the only reason I do it. I mean, it's not easy to do this. My wife comes along on most trips. She jokes and says it's her job to give the chocolate afterwards to make me feel better. But you know, I do have conversations with people. I've had just a few short weeks ago, spoke in Columbus, Georgia, and a lady came up to me and showed me where she had just given a resignation letter to her boss, and she took it back from him and said, "You re-engaged me with why I came to do this." I got the opportunity to minister to a grandmother who had just backed over her own grandson 2 weeks before and killed him. And even in Scottsdale, Arizona years ago, had the opportunity. This guy wasn't even in healthcare. He was just in the AV department, was there to film a video. And I had the opportunity to talk to him afterwards. He had left a suicide note on the table for his wife and two girls. And the only reason he took the job to video me that day was to get a little extra money for him before he left.
Oh, wow. Oh,
so we had the opportunity to. So just, you know, you'll understand this. God has his way of doing things.
Yeah.
And while my wife and son were a huge loss to me and everybody that knew him, he saw that I was going to have the opportunity to speak to people like that.
Yeah.
It's the only reason I can explain it.
I firmly believe that. Absolutely. All those things in our lives are not, we have no control over them, and they're God's choice. Yeah. That's the only way we can explain these horrible events.
And of course, I get the question all the time, why would God do this to you? And my first response is, God didn't do this. Three men running a stop sign did it.
Yeah. Right.
God chose to use it for something
else. Exactly. I love that.
It's got to have been so draining doing this for so long.
Types of things that can draw people away from God.
Yeah.
And more credit to you. Of course, it helps with your minister.
Well, it also you've been helps through that I had a tremendous family and church family even around me at that time, because I was pastoring a church. And I mean, for 4 months that I lived in that town before we did move back to Nashville, start the new church, my family didn't have to fix a single meal. I mean, that's what little towns will do for you, that kind of loving. Yeah. But my sister, I have two older sisters, but the youngest of the two at one point looked at me and said, I'm just telling you, you don't have permission to quit. If you try, I will kick your butt. and I had friends who would pick up the phone and say similar things to me. They just knew I needed to hear that. I hope I'm having the opportunity now to give that same kind of message to people.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah. Well, on behalf of the industry, thank you for spreading that message. I think it's something that we as in the ambulatory surgery center, patients that come to our centers don't expect to have a bad outcome. We're largely elective, and these procedures are very short and they're considered relatively non-invasive or non-critical. So we need to hear that message, especially as we move into an era where we're doing much more complex procedures.
I mean, the stuff you're doing nowadays, people had 4 days in a hospital, and now you're getting it done and walking them out.
That's right.
That's a tremendous accomplishment, but at the same time, it's scary to think about.
And we're starting to look a lot more like a hospital, and we have a lot more of those hospital risks that we have there, too.
All right. Well, thanks so much for talking with us today.
Absolutely. It was a pleasure, and thank you very much for giving me the opportunity to do it.
Great. Thanks. So that was tough to interview. It's tough to listen to his story. Mm-hmm. He wrote a book called A Twist of Faith, and I'm going to give a link for people to purchase that book online. Yeah. Great book. I've only read half of it so far, but it's a great message, and please support him in any way you can.
It's such an amazing thing, very inspiring to see when something like this can happen. There's so many different ways you can take it. And the fact that he puts himself out there and put out that forgiveness to do some good and get something good out of it. And I'm sure in the end, he's much better off for it. His family's much better off for it. And hopefully, quite sure that he's saved people, even the specific instances he gave.
So there's a couple of takeaways that I had that I just want to kind of mention here. You know, he talked about making sure that we have a friendly environment. During the session, he mentioned that when he walked into the hospital, the receptionist or the person at the information desk didn't have a very friendly face. And of course, he was going on to hear the worst news that any father can possibly hear. And his vision right now of that first thing at the hospital was this unfriendly person. And another interesting thing he mentioned is when people come into your surgery center, come into your hospital, a healthcare provider, that, you know, nobody really wants to be there.
Yeah, yeah. So, hey, it's great to have you here today, you know, and they're probably internally rolling their eyes like, well, not really.
Yeah.
So, you know, just saying, you know, we understand you don't want to be here. We're going to do everything we can to make this go as smoothly and be as pleasant as it can be.
Right, and get you out so that you can get back to your real life as quickly as possible. And he also emphasized the importance of being honest with the patients, and mentioned that during his ordeal, there were times when they said that, you know, everything was going to be fine, the patient was going to be fine, and that, of course, was not the case. I love one of the comments. He said, don't be weary of doing good. So he really is very positive about the healthcare industry, about healthcare workers, and really don't be weary of doing good. Of course, that was his religious side talking a little bit.
Yeah, but stay inspired, you know, keep motivated every day. Right. And he did kind of say, if you get to that point where you're really not, where you don't know what you're doing there every day, maybe, you know, it's that's not the, time to move on.
Don't use medical speak. Another one of his points.
It seems so basic, but it just becomes ingrained sometimes and you don't realize. So, you know, be sure even asking people if they understand, but doing it in a way where they're not going to be embarrassed to say, no, I don't know what you're talking about. Right. You know, make sure to reiterate things, write them down.
So the thing that my biggest takeaway at the end was how he pointed out that the organization, he found out later that the organization had improved dramatically over the past year and had reduced the number of Sentinel events in that organization from 14 in the prior year to one. Unfortunately, the one was Ridley's son. I'm tearing up just thinking about it right now. And so his point, quite bluntly, is that to the patient, the only acceptable level of errors is zero. And I think that's something we have to remember is that, you know, no matter where we're heading, as long as we have anything that goes wrong, we have improvement that we can do.
And I was looking at it ahead of time because maybe you've had no incidents, but be very vigilant. Try to think of any way it could happen, like some of our other interviews that we've had about just keeping that mind frame of what can go wrong and looking for failure so you can catch it before it happens whenever possible.
So great message. Sorry about the downer, but I think there is a very positive message behind this also. So let's take a short break and we'll come back and tell you what's going on in the ASC industry.
So, John, there is a lot going on with ambulatory healthcare strategies. Can you give our listeners an update on the company and its services?
Sure. Well, as you well know, we are growing fast. We now have 10 employees. You were number 9. We've since hired another summer intern, though I guess it's going to be a fall intern, actually, now. all of our employees are scattered throughout the East Coast with a cadre of independent consultants that we call upon when we need them. And probably one of the most exciting news that we had recently is Alex Bornham, our director of operations and our go-to guy for life safety issues, passed his NFPA certification and became a CLSS-HC, which stands for Certified Life Safety Specialist for Healthcare. So we're now offering life safety surveys, which is something somewhat new to us, and are included in all of our retainers.
So what is a retainer?
So the core of our business is really retainer-based services. While we regularly help centers out with mock surveys, survey preparation, and post-survey mitigation, the core of what we do is make sure that you don't have to prepare for a survey or deal with the complex post-survey plans of correction. To that end, we have a regulatory compliance retainer, which is basically a way for centers to outsource quality improvement, risk management, infection control, emergency preparedness, and other CMS and accreditation oversight services.
And what is included in that retainer?
While all of our services can be tailored to the exact needs of the organization, our standard retainer includes either monthly or quarterly visits to the center, review of all quality improvement, risk management, infection control, and emergency services activities and documentation, preparation for attendance at and preparation of the minutes for the quality improvement meeting, the medical executive meeting, and the governing body meetings. Annual updates to the policy and procedure manual to comply with state CMS and accreditation requirements. We also prepare educational programs for orientation and annual mandatory education, and we can actually do those educational programs too if you wish. And of course, 24/7 access to me and my incredible staff for issues that might come up.
Well, that sounds expensive.
Well, I think the price might surprise many of our listeners. But the way you have to look at it is this: how can you afford not to? Many of our centers simply cannot afford or cannot find an administrator that has all of the education, training, experience to handle quality improvement, risk management, emergency services, and infection control. And our service allows centers to hire good nurse managers that can focus on those things that they're best trained for, and we handle the rest.
So how do our listeners learn more about this?
Well, feel free to give me a call at 585-594-1167. That's 585-594-1167, or send us an email at info@ah-strategies.com. That's info@ahhealthcare-strategies.com.
So let's talk about some upcoming events in the ASC industry. Every week, we will inform you of upcoming events. If you would like your event to be included in the podcast, please send the event information to info@ascpodcast.com.
So we're recording on Sunday, and in about, as soon as we're done with this podcast here, we're going to be heading down to the Pennsylvania Ambulatory Surgery Association annual meeting, which is tomorrow, October 1st, or which is on the day,
the day you'll be listening.
Listening, October 1st, 2018 at the Sheridan Harrisburg Hershey Hotel in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania.
The OR Excellence 2018, sponsored by our friends at Outpatient Surgery Magazine, is October 3rd through 5th, 2018 at the Harbor Beach Marriott Resort and Spa in Fort Lauderdale, Florida.
Which is this week, just noting, so at the end of this week. The New York State Association of ASC's Fall Conference will be held at the Roosevelt Hotel on October 11, 2018. I will be speaking there, and we will be doing a podcast from there.
The 5th Annual New York Metro ASC Symposium, November 2, 2018, at the Marriott Marquis in the heart of Times Square.
The CASA Infection Prevention Seminar is November 7th through 8th, 2018, in Costa Mesa.
2019 ASCA Winter Seminars are January 17th to 19th in Austin, Texas at the Hilton Austin. The 2019 conference will include three tracks, ASC Management Essentials, Coding Update, and Reimbursement Strategies and Infection Prevention Techniques in ASCs.
And lastly, ASCA 2019 will be at the Gaylord Opryland Resort and Convention Center in Nashville, Tennessee, May 15th through the 18th, 2019. Well, that's it for this episode of the ASC Podcast with John Gailey. Join us again in 2 weeks, and please spread the word about our podcast with your friends and colleagues, and do us the honor of hitting the subscribe button.
This podcast is an educational and operational tool and is not intended to be a comprehensive resource for all the rules, regulations, and standards that an ambulatory surgery center must meet. The advice provided should not be considered as, nor does it constitute legal advice or opinion. When reviewing specific situations involving legal and regulatory issues, attorneys and other professionals should be consulted. This has been a production of Eden Group Development, all rights reserved. We would like to thank this week's sponsors. First, Ambulatory Healthcare Strategies, one of the nation's leading regulatory compliance and financial oversight firms. For a free consultation, contact John Gailey today at 585-594-1167 or through email at info@ah-strategies.com. And Eden Group Development, which publishes ASC Regulatory Compliance Series, the ASC industry's leading books, including the Survey Guide for ASCs, a guide to the CMS conditions for coverage and interpretive guidelines for ambulatory surgery centers, and Ambulatory Surgery Center Governance, a guide for ambulatory surgery center owners and governing body members. These must-have books are available on Amazon and Barnes & Noble or directly from the publisher at reg-books.com. That's reg-books.com. If you are interested in advertising or sponsoring the ASC Podcast with John Gailey, please email us at info@ascpodcast.com. We would love to hear your questions and comments. Please email us at comments@ascpodcast.com.